Para X. The views expressed and the opinions given by the individual host and their guests do not necessarily reflect those of Para X, its affiliates, or its sponsors.
Merry meet and merry part, bright the cheeks and warm the heart. But tread the circle thrice about to keep unwelcome spirits out. Bide within the law you must, in perfect love. Trust. Mind the threefold laws you should, three times bad and three times good. These eight words the reed fulfill, and ye harm none to what ye will.
Welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Now, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Merry meet everybody, and welcome to Stirring the Cauldron. Tonight we're going to be talking about rituals, customs, and funerary etiquette for modern pagans with author Martellus. Sorry, I'm going to flub that all night. She's a mortician, a medium, a necromancer, a British traditional Wiccan witch, and is the high priestess of the Coven of the Leaves, which is a Gardnerian training group. And we're going to be talking about her book, Do I Have to Wear Black? The book is a look at death and dying from the perspective of magical and pagan communities. Now, as usual, questions are always welcome from the chat room, so don't be afraid to ask. And also, don't be afraid to join us here in chat at paraxradionetwork.com. I can vouch for most of the regulars in here, and they don't bite. Well, okay. I'm lying, but anyway. Let's get started. Martellus, welcome. How are you?
Hi, good. Just a quick little piece of information. I go by they, them, and use high priestess rather than priestess.
Oh, okay. Very good. I grab stuff when I get it, and sometimes it's not quite right, but, you know. That's what you're here for. You're here to correct me. I love it when I get corrected, because then I learn something, too. So, you know, I'm not one of those that get the bottom lip pouting or anything.
I think so, it's such a wonderful wide world we live in, so much variety, and it's great when we can sort of have those moments to just accept and be, I think.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. You know, now I have to begin by saying that when I read through your book, and when I usually read through other people's books to prepare questions or comments to go along with the interview, the process is fairly easy. I mean, there are certain topics that just catch my eye, and those are the things that I will generally focus on. But this was different. I'd read a little bit and jot down a little note, then keep going. But before I even got halfway through with the next thing, I was going back and changing what I thought was really good to chat about because there was something better. And that went through the whole book. I mean, it made it more interesting, but in a way it was kind of frustrating because now I can't share everything that I would like to in a short hour, but I'm really happy to have such an interesting and informative book to refer to. So thank you for that.
Hey, that's what it's there for. I felt it was really a shame that we didn't have something to fill that need, and I set out to make it exist.
So. Well, there was so much that I never even gave a thought to that's what kind of makes it so neat. But also, I mean, I know you wrote the book for modern pagans, but there are a whole lot of things in there that are very helpful and I think necessary information that non-pagans can use as well. I mean, you know, there are rituals and rites and ideas, and customs in each tradition that people can kind of grab up and, you know, it will be useful for them.
There are even atheistic and even a set of Christian rituals for someone who might be in the closet and wanted something that was inviting to all.
Okay. Yeah. Go ahead.
I say often, I know that something you're supposed to do as an author is really know who your audience is and talk to that audience. But I cheated a bit by speaking to so many different audiences, and I hope it was successful, but my goal was to make it a book that anyone could get something out of.
And I think they will. As you said, there's just so many different things. Even if somebody picks up one specific thing that I'm going to talk about down the line, that anybody can do, and it's a really brilliant idea. But let me backtrack a little bit, because it takes a special kind of person to volunteer at a hospice, and lots of people eventually wear out, both mentally and physically. But in your case, I mean, you did that. You were a volunteer, but being a volunteer in hospice was not enough to satisfy your deities or yourself. And then you went to mortuary school as the next logical step. Another pursuit that takes a special type of person. How did all of this come together for you?
I would just like to say I'm still volunteering for hospice, actually. I've been volunteering since 2001.
Wow.
But, yeah, like you said, it just wasn't enough to satisfy what the gods were asking of me. And, you know, just continuing to listen and be responsive where I could to where I was being sent and where I was being called, that's always been really important to me.
You know, yeah.
As someone who died once, you know, I was declared dead. I was dead for 8 minutes once, and feel like I was sent back with a purpose, and, you know, being alive is a gift that I was given. So I try and honor that gift by filling this need where I can.
Yeah, well, that's kind of interesting that, you know, sometimes things happen and it just snaps in our brain when they do, bad things happen or learning curve happens, you know, sometimes that's what happens with various things. You think you're just coasting along and then something will come up and kind of hit you up at the side of the head. And it's important to listen to the muses then, because then you know what direction to take, right?
Absolutely.
So the introduction to the book kind of explains why we need the book. And I have a very good example of just that, because someone who saw the banner about this week's show sent me a note, and they said that they were surprised that there were different ways of funerals and burials for pagans, because a couple of pagan friends' funerals that she had attended were just like every other non-pagan funeral. And she now, having read the book and seen the title, said it was possibly because it was the families of the deceased who arranged the funeral and burial, and they didn't know. I mean, they weren't pagan, so they did it the way that they would normally do. And that could be, you know, a good reason why you wrote this book, because there aren't any books like yours available, and it enables both pagans and their families to understand that they have choices, and they never thought they might have had them before, and that's really a blessing.
You know, when I was a student in mortuary school, one of our classes, its general purpose was to teach us the funerary rites and rituals of different religious groups that we might encounter. And we were given a textbook that was meant to contain everything we would ever need. And, you know, I have to tell you, Marla, it looked like a pamphlet. It couldn't have been thicker than a child's coloring book.
Wow.
And within it were just variants on Christianity, you know, Catholic funerals or Lutheran funerals or Jewish funerals, or, you know, they all sort of stayed within that Abrahamic realm. And, you know, then a few notes about what you might see if the deceased was a member of a fraternal order, like Freemasonry, for example. But I'm looking at this book and thinking, this is not a picture of who we are in the world.
Mm-hmm.
I just thought it was such a crime that that's what we were given.
They didn't know any better, I guess. I mean, not making excuses, but, you know, people are pretty secular in their own minds, not even necessarily religiously. They grow up a certain way. They think, you know, that's the only way, because they're not curious enough to look into other things, because why should they in their minds? You know, I have it down pat. I know what I'm doing. And so why should I, you know what Joe Smith is doing? But that's kind of the sad part. The interesting part is that pagans have such an open mind that they're always curious about other people and what they do and how they do it. And you know, we embrace everybody and don't, you know, look down our noses or anything. And so I guess it takes the pagan to make a book like this because you've got that open mind, but it must have been so research, so much research to do, research intensive. I mean, did this book take a lot longer than, say, most people would take in writing a book because of that?
Well, I have to be very honest with you and say that I'm not an author. I sort of fell backwards into it, but so I can't really answer that question because I don't know how long people are taking to write books. But I can say that I wrote that book with just a furious intention to make it exist. I wrote it with two brand new twin babies in my lap, and I wrote it in a pandemic, and I wrote it while exhausted and finishing up another college degree.
Oh, wow.
I wrote it in about 6 months.
Okay, you should get a Purple Heart for that because you didn't sit down and write a book in a quiet room 8 hours a day.
I did not. No,
no. So yeah, you're amongst the high echelon of, oh my God, really? And you did such a good job. That's the other part of it.
I can I can say that I finished that book needing surgery in both wrists and both elbows because I gave myself carpal tunnel and ulnar entrapments in both arms.
Oh, but it's such a labor of love. You forgive yourself for doing that, I guess.
It's true.
You know, you get what you deserve, but not in a painful way. Because okay, so each chapter in the book talks in depth, and I mean in depth, about the beliefs and rituals of several different traditions like British traditional Wicca, Druidry, and Thelema. And that encompasses things like mourning customs and rites and rituals and resources. I mean, way more things that I can mention in each chapter. I mean, it's chock full of stuff, but each chapter has several pages covering aspects. I mean, it's almost like what you just said about when you got that pamphlet about, you know, different cultures and how their burial things that are really tiny. It was like a pamphlet. Well, here, each chapter has that more stuff, that more kind of stuff in there in all aspects. And you have like 10 or 9 different traditions, right?
There's quite a few in there. And honestly, if I could have, I'd have written a book twice that size and had twice as many. But, you know, there comes a point where you do have to choose. And I felt like that was the best and broadest picture that I could give up to a point without delving into cultural practices and, you know, making sure that I was, you know, helping people within the funerary industry sort of see a wide picture of what these rites might entail is really important.
It is. Did you start out with what, 10, 20, 30 different paths and then narrow it down to 9, or did
just
jump up in your face and say, here, take me, I'm supposed to be in the book?
I mean, I must have had mountains of index cards. Like every time you see one of those movies with like the policemen and they've got all the like strings and thumbtacks. That was my dining room for a while. And I was so lucky to be able to work with so many different people who contributed to the book. I mean, definitely don't give me even half the credit because I reached out to just so many wonderful people in different traditions who gave me feedback and submitted bits of writing and bits of ritual and just tons of people. If you look at the contributors section, who really brought it up to life. And
the thing is, you knew who to ask.
Sometimes I didn't. Sometimes that was hard. Sometimes.
but you found it, and that's you know, kind of amazing. Now, there's one chapter that contains a section called Over My Dead Body. Can you explain that? I kind of liked it.
So each of the chapters on different faith groups have an Over My Dead Body section, and several of the ancillary chapters on grieving and so forth as well. Mm-hmm. Those pullouts were meant particularly for people within the funeral industry who may have picked up this book or been given it as a guide to how to serve families in those groups. So it delves a little bit into just basics about how the body should be casketed or what their needs or lack thereof in terms of embalming and body preparation might be, what they might prefer for flowers and funeral layout and that sort of thing.
Yeah, that's why it's so comprehensive, because of all the, I mean, it's good for the trade, it's good for pagans, it's good for non-pagans, but you've got so much in there that everybody can pick from and learn from, and I hope the mortician industry gets, mortuary industry, uses that as kind of a textbook instead of that little pamphlet, because I was also thinking, how difficult is it to find a mortuary who can take the needs of the people that may be something that they're not accustomed to and do a funeral without something like that?
I have to say that it has been my extreme pleasure that in the last couple of months, two different mortuary sciences colleges, including my alma mater, have picked up the books as required reading as part of their curriculum, and I was asked to create a series of lectures going over pagan faith practices that would become part of the curriculum for students, and that has given me so much joy. I can't even begin to express that.
Yeah, well, you know, I mean, I've never heard of a lot of these things. The first time I even heard about a green burial was someone who owned property, and they had a casket that was biodegradable, and they put their mom in the casket, no embalming or anything like that, just totally natural, and then planted a tree over the casket so that she was giving back to the earth. And that was the first I ever heard of anything that was, you know, pagan related. And I thought it was wonderful.
That's funny, too, because that would have been such an ordinary way to respond to death in, say, as recently as the 1950s.
Did they go back? I mean, I guess way back when people lived out in the country and they didn't have a lot of money. I mean, you know, there were always family plots on people's property, and I'm sure they just put them in a casket and everything. Maybe they didn't plant a tree over them, but, you know, I guess as time went on, people moved to cities and people, you know, mortuaries popped up here and there, and they didn't have to worry about things like, you know, well, what are we going to do with, you know, grandma or what would she have wanted or anything? I mean, you know, they dug a hole and planted somebody.
I think it has more to do with the denial juice we're drinking in the modern world, really. But we didn't see really the rise of more what you might call industrialized or professional funerary work until around the time of the Civil War. And we had so much death around us all the time. And, you know, people just trying to get their loved ones home to be buried, these battlefield deaths where no one could recognize or find or claim their loved one. So you had these sort of pop-up shops of embalmers who would set up in tents next to battlefields and ply their wares as they experimented at the same time as they were learning and creating this trade. They would figure out the best way to embalm someone so that they would survive the train ride home, so that they could make it there undecayed. And that just sort of stayed with us. And certainly by the time of, you know, World War One, World War Two, those ideas were really planted in our heads as a nation.
I don't know where I heard this, but it just popped into my head about somebody being sent home from somewhere in a whiskey bottle, a cask, a big cask, a barrel. And that was what kept them getting home in one piece.
You hear a lot of stories like that, a lot of folk tales about people being put in wine casks or similar things. And it would be temporarily effective, yes.
Yeah, because especially on the battlefield, I mean, would you have like formaldehyde, for example, would that be handy to do embalmings? Or did you even have time in the battlefield to embalm somebody? I mean, it was crazy.
For example, we didn't use aldehyde-based chemicals for embalming until relatively recently, really. During the time of the Civil War, we used arsenic-based solutions, which is where we hear all those statistics about the environmental dangers. Most of that groundwater pollution is a byproduct of that era, actually.
Oh, wow. Wow. I guess you use what you have on hand, and yeah, that's kind of crazy. Now, some of the customs from the various paths that you have listed won't resonate with everybody, but there are so many. So in your research, have you found, even though they're so different in many ways, have you found a common denominator between them all?
I think that the commonality that I have seen between death in any culture, in any faith practice, modern or ancient, is always going to be food. There's always that connection between giving and receiving food, sharing a meal together, those kinds of things just sort of speak in a very honest and humble sort of way to everyone. I really do think food is the language of our grief.
Mm-hmm. And grief is something that everybody goes through no matter what. I mean, you know, whoever you are, grief is part of life. And everybody grieves differently. I mean, there's no textbook on grief, and you know, they take their time, but yeah, that too is a common denominator. I mentioned a while ago about some information that non-pagans can greatly benefit from this book, and we've got like 7 minutes before we go to break. Go ahead.
I did want to interject just on the,
please,
on the topic of food and grief. There's a book I'm very fond of, and just one of my favorite little things to read is a book called Being Dead is No Excuse, the official Southern Lady's Guide to Hosting the Perfect Funeral. And it's just this wonderful cookbook collection of common funerary foods. And there's just so many surprising and just heartwarming little things to be found in it. It's just this wonderful little book.
Oh, that's great. Because, you know, I mean, that it is. You're always cooking, bringing a casserole to somebody's house so they don't have to cook for a week. And pretty soon you have like 87 casseroles taped in the kitchen and you don't know what to do with them. But yeah, cooking, I mean, eating is another thing. I mean, eating goes along with grief, with happiness, with sadness, with all kinds of things. I mean, we're born to eat and enjoy company and cooking for company. So that's a good idea. I like that.
Oh, yes.
And if it's in the Southern way, you know, it kind of like green apples, green tomatoes.
Fried green tomatoes. Here in the South, we do funeral potatoes, and you have to do the perfect deviled egg for the funeral. That's just how it is.
Deviled eggs are wonderful. Yes.
Oh, yes.
I got a question from the chat room. Speaking of foods, have you heard of sin eating?
Absolutely. It's something that I practice when I'm asked to. And I know some other individuals who practice it as well. In fact, I was recently interviewed by Gaz Morgan, who hosts Bizarro Aficionado, and they too are a sin eater.
Some people might not know what sin eaters are, so why don't you give them a little quick 101?
The idea of sin eating is that in many cases, if the deceased are going to haunt or be ill at rest, it's because of unfinished business or some harm they've committed in life or something that keeps them unsettled. the sin eater is passed a morsel of food over the deceased's body, and they sort of make a silent promise that as they eat that food, they take the burden of guilt for those actions or that unfinished business on themselves.
Yeah, it's kind of a really great custom, you know, I mean, for mentally to kind of clear the head and know that, you know, you're getting something done, things are going up to the universe and you're making promises that you keep, and, you know, it's a good thing.
I think it's interesting, the idea of taking those things onto yourself, knowing basically the idea is that you're accepting that you yourself will go into the grave unsettled because you carry all those burdens on behalf of the dead. But I think that's a really powerful gift.
Yeah, it absolutely is. All right, what I want to get to right before the break is something that it just hit me that, wow, this is such a great idea. I found it kind of vitally important for everybody, and I think that we should all sit down and do this, and that is to compose an ethical will. It's necessary to do, and way different than just naming which family member gets the antique silver tea service. You know, one very important part of the ethical will is leaving information about yourself to those family members who might have been very young when, you know, you passed, and they really didn't get to know who you were as a person, or maybe even older ones who were so wrapped up in their own lives that they never stopped to ask grandma, you know, what was it like when you came over on the boat, or, you know, where did you meet grandpa, or something like that. I mean, things we all realize too late that we should have asked those questions. But if somebody sits down and writes an ethical will about their lives and experiences, I think that's such a blessing.
It's certainly not an original idea of my own. It's something you see quite a lot in Jewish communities, but it appears in the Bible quite a bit, and some Christian sects practice it as well. But just that idea of taking down the emotion and the feeling and the stories of who you are, for better or for worse, the way you want them to be told to the next generation, be it through journaling or sharing that favorite recipe or saying why you chose this certain person for the silver tea service. These things can be really powerful. And I think particularly for people that use such words to define themselves as witch, that's a very strong word. And we might know what it means to our family today, but what will it mean to your great-grandchildren or great-great-grandchildren when they hear this ancestor was a witch? What will that mean to them if you don't take a moment to tell them?
Yeah, because, you know, it's like Chinese whispers. Things go down from generation to generation and change a little bit with each telling. So if you have it in writing and explain what things are, there's no question or no doubt, right?
I'm not familiar with that turn of phrase, but it's sort of like a game of telephone, I guess.
Yes, exactly. Chinese whispers. It is exactly a game of telephone. So, yeah, things change. Two little thing in the chat room. Somebody wrote, eating post-funeral meals of everyone at the funeral is fine, but don't bring the leftovers home. A little superstition. And you had a death in the family. You don't visit others, because that would bring death to other people's homes.
Those are certainly very culturally specific, and very particularly faith-based. Mm-hmm. In some cultures, taking food home does have particular blessings associated with it, but for others it would be very taboo. Visiting others is a less common idea, but you will see more of a request that people not visit the bereaved for a certain amount of time, particularly in Hellenistic practices. There's a request that you not visit the family for 24 hours after the burial so that ritual cleaning can be done.
Mm-hmm. Or, you know, it's everybody, like in our house, what did they do? Put a cover over the mirror. You know, couldn't look at the reflections. That was the thing. Or, you know, washing your hands outside before you go in and stuff. There's so many different cultures and so many different ways of doing things that, you know, that just talking about that could fill a whole hour, you know.
Oh, certainly. Mm-hmm.
But we're going to go take a short break now. So everybody don't go away, and we'll be back shortly.
Don't go away. There's more Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks right after these important messages.
Hi, I'm Kimberly Juarez with Cat Paranormal of Minnesota.
Hi, I'm Willow Lehman-Shawn, psychic medium, Dark Nola Paranormal, New Orleans.
And I'm Jerry Ayers with Supernatural Investigators of Minnesota. And together, we are The Calling. Every Wednesday night, 7 p.m. Central Standard Time and 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, only on ParaXRadioNetwork.com.
Hi, this is Marla Brooks from Stirring the Cauldron. Thursdays are a great night on the ParaX Radio Network. On the first and third Thursdays of the month at 8 p.m., it's Tango and Friends, hosted by Bruce Tango. And on the alternate Thursdays at 8 p.m., tune in to Stirring the Cauldron, the archive podcast. Every week at 9 p.m. Eastern, join me on Stirring the Cauldron Live. And then at 10 p.m., stick around for New Aeon Now with Lily Alley, Davron Michaels, and Christine Matza. Finally, to round out the night, join Dr. Kelly Renee Schutz on the Paranormal Encounters podcast. All this, every Thursday, right here on ParaX.
Missed an episode of Stirring the Cauldron? Then be sure to check out MarlaBrooks.com and check out the archive. And while you're there, check out Marla's weekly Witches Oracle card reading. Explore the site to find many great resources, such as information on tarot, oracle readings, metaphysical consultations, and links to all of Marla's books. That's MarlaBrooks.com. Welcome back to Stirring the Cauldron. Once again, here's your host, Marla Brooks.
Hey, welcome back, everybody. My guest tonight is Mortellus, and we're talking about rituals, customs, and funerary etiquette for the modern pagans from her book, Do I Have to Wear Black? And before I go any further, I would be remiss if I didn't have you answer that question. Do we have to wear black?
I think that depends entirely on which faith group you are attending a funeral for, like I said in the book. So many different groups ask that you wear different colors, that it's important to sort of know who you're attending a funeral for.
But you don't have to wear black necessarily.
Well, not necessarily.
That's the blanket thing that everybody thinks. All right. There's just a question from the chat room. Maybe that came in later, but it was asking about finding a mortuary that would conduct a pagan funeral. So we already covered that. So we can move on.
If anyone is looking for a recommendation, if they reach out to me and let me know what area they're in, I'm happy to help connect them with someone.
Are there, like, you know, a lot of them in general across the 50 states? I mean,
not a ton, but we try and stay connected.
So, that's good. Because, you know, some people go, well, you know, you can't go 500 miles to find somebody. But as long as there's enough of them out there, you know, the people that need them will be able to find them.
Exactly.
That's kind of the way I think. All right. Let's talk a little bit more about grief and mourning. It's inevitable. And no matter who you are, what you believe in, there's no getting around it. And you have a chapter in the book that includes some hands-on rites and rituals, like letting go poppet ritual, a morning dream pillow, or a coin toss spell. So those things really do help. I mean, there's no coin toss that's going to, you know, make anything a lot better, but talk a little bit about the dream pillow, for example. What's the function? How do you do it?
So I don't have that ritual right in front of me to remember.
Okay, more. All right. Then what's it for?
The general idea is, so a dream pillow is something that we don't hear a lot of these days, but we hear things like a sachet or that sort of thing. So, any sort of like mojo bag that you might put under your pillow, but in ye olden days, you might have seen an entire pillow sewn that would be stuffed with herbs or other ingredients, particularly things like hops, which have sort of a sedative effect in enough quantity. It's funny, you don't just need to drink the alcohol. You can just stuff a pillow with hops. I have no idea how expensive that would be. Maybe it would be ridiculous, but the idea of this particular ritual is that it contains items that are in line with providing comfort and sanctuary to the bereaved, but also providing a calming antidepressant quality to the recently deceased. Dream space tends to be somewhere that we connect with the dead. It's just an easier place for them to get to us and us to get to them. So finding a place of sort of peace and comfort so that the bereaved can sleep peacefully, I think is really useful. It's so important for the recently deceased to have time to focus on what their journey is at that moment, and so important for the bereaved to just grieve mundanely. So I think those little boundary setting items are really important.
Okay, I just grabbed the book really quick, and some of the things that you can put in the dream pillow are, first you got to get a cloth bag, a linen, preferably linen. You can put in grave dirt. You can put in possibly from the grave of a loved one. Red baker's thread, tonka bean for courage, purple bull thistle, copewell stone, hops. I mean, a lot of things, and probably things that make you feel better to put. I mean, there's no rule to this. These are kind of suggestions, right?
I think some of them certainly have very specific uses. Mm-hmm. Copal has a very calming quality for the dead. If you have a recently deceased person that is agitated, if they died unexpectedly or unhappily, that sort of thing, burning copal can be very useful. So adding it into this pillow can be very, very useful in that way. Bull thistle has protective guardian qualities. Again, tonka for courage. These items do all have really specific purposes, but that's not to say that you can't add additional items as are important to you. You just need to make certain that you are aware of the effect that they have on the living and the dead. For example, burning or using myrrh is always a bad idea in a recently deceased situation, because it has a thinning quality and it also attracts the dead. So it's sort of like turning up the volume, giving them a bunch of caffeine and then trying to go to sleep.
Yeah.
So you want to sort of have an understanding of what you're adding and what your purpose is in adding it, I think.
What and why? Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
Mm-hmm. Well, it was funny in chat room, Cece just made a comment because dream pillows are not just for mourning. And she said that she's made dream pillows with chamomile and crystals.
Yes, they're great for all kinds of things. And I thought that using it for the recently bereaved was really just sort of a fun use of that kind of item, since they do often rely on sort of calming, sweetening, sedative qualities, like, you know, the chamomile and those sorts of things. Just sort of tapping into that as a way to calm the living and the dead in this time of grief, I thought was a really fun way to use that kind of magic.
Mm-hmm. Another question that just popped in the chat room, is there a ritual or practice for helping the dead reincarnate?
There is, and I would just be delighted to tell you that I just turned in last week my second book, and it has an entire chapter on that topic.
Oh my God. Okay, let's talk a teeny bit about it.
So I'm writing a book about writing, have written. It's finished after all this time. It's about just sort of an introduction, a primer, if you will, to necromantic practice. You know, we look at necromancy as being this sort of over there, hypothetical kind of dark magic sort of thing. But I think people would be really surprised to realize that death magic is really pervasive, and it's a huge part of what we're already doing. We're just using different words, and if we sort of dispel our fear of death, it's a really, really important and useful part of our practice.
Yeah. I mean, when you hear the word necromancy, unless you really know what it's about, it's like, okay, I'm taking two steps behind, two steps back, because this person's a necromancer, you know, necro, ooh, you know, like, I don't know.
I definitely get some sideways looks here and there.
And I think, you know, wearing a pentagram and getting sideways looks is bad. probably necromancer is just a teeny bit worse.
It's funny, you wear the pentagram and you get funny looks in the grocery store, but you're accepted in your community, right? If mm-hmm. you call yourself a necromancer, everyone hates you. <It's> a pagan community, mundane community. It's like the Baptists and the Wiccans really come together on how much they don't like necromancers. That's terrible, I know, but
no, it's true.
It's true. It's definitely one of those last taboos.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, you got to. It's just, got to live it down at some point. But you know, nobody ever will. I mean, it's like the word witch. You know, to some people, they understand. They know what we are. They know what we do. We're fine. But you know, we're never gonna get the broom riding wart thing on the face kind of cackling thing out of anybody's mind. So, you know, same thing with the necromancer. But you know, I think people look at the necromancer in high esteem because they're probably afraid of them and just, you know.
I often tell people that I think as a necromancer, I'm rather a glorified daycare. That's my role. Think about it. In the last year and a half, we're pushing 2 years of this pandemic now. Mm-hmm. We've had a lot of death in the world, and if you read my book, you know that next of kin just is what it is legally. And sometimes you find yourself saddled with something unexpected. And there are so many people out there who found themselves next of kin to someone who was their abuser or any number of just terrible situations where they find themselves staring at an urn of cremated remains, wondering what they're supposed to do with this person that was horrible to them. Mm-hmm. And from where I'm sitting, I have a couple lined up on my desk that families have asked me to take in because they can't manage them in their own home. They're having poltergeist activity, or it just brings them too much pain to look at them. And mm-hmm. so that's my job as a necromancer. I have my daycare of unwanted assholes.
Lucky you.
Lucky me, I know.
But then that's, you know, subjective. They could be really nice people, but just didn't get along with their families or something. You never know.
The ones on my shelf were all incarcerated at different points for things they perpetrated against their next of kin. So
there you go. Okay.
Yes. So we know they were not nice people. Yeah. But here they are warded into my office, and they can throw things all they like, and I don't mind. Mm-hmm. So
good. I like that. Speaking of kind of neat, friendly people. The chapter on the underworld that you have probably, I'm guessing, was one of the most difficult to write because, unlike the others, you can't just do a ton of research and come up with a definitive answer about the other side, life after death, heaven and hell. How do you research something like that have no answers for, and yet you made it very interesting? I mean, it's a very thought-provoking chapter.
It's definitely my favorite chapter in the book, but also the one I hate the most. Like I said, I did die once, and the circumstances were not wonderful, and I'm definitely not going to put myself through talking about that tonight, but no. Go read the book or listen to a different podcast I've told the story on. But in that experience, I experienced and saw what the underworld was to me, at least. And I'm certainly open to the idea that it was my coma-addled brain, you know, making up fiction, but it was a very real and altering experience for me. So I've spent a lifetime trying to put that into words, and being able to put them on those pages, I think, was really powerful for me as a person, and really not something I set out to do. I think it's one of those moments in your life where a deity comes calling to collect on their dead. You know, you get that hand on the shoulder. It's like, well, here's the moment. This is where it goes.
And you're supposed to do it. I mean, you have to tell, you know, otherwise you wouldn't have been compelled to do it. And it's kind of cathartic at the same time. So
it is. And it's been such a, like they say, a mixed bag. I've gotten comments from people or emails or private messages saying that I was the first person that they heard describe dying like they experienced it, or telling me stories where something like that happened to them. And those things are very powerful. And then, of course, I'll get just really terrible, horrible emails with, you know, death threats. And just like, if only you had stayed dead. And just,
oh, my God.
People are horrible.
This is when we make poppets, you know, just so simple little poppets, just like, get the hell out of my face kind of poppets.
It's not my style. I just ask the gods that they receive what they deserve. Maybe they deserve good and have never had it. So who am I to decide?
Well, that's nice, because you have a nice thing in there. I usually look for kind of an eye for an eye kind of thing, because it's, you know, that's what they deserve. And so, you know, but that's me.
I figure if I leave it up to the gods to decide, then they can dole out whatever is necessary, good or bad.
Yes, and they will. And we just have the faith that they will, and that's important. All right, so in the chapter, No Two Deaths Are the Same, you cover something that I was very happy to see that you included in that thing, and that is on companion animals, which includes rituals and rites and helpful tips for end-of-life care for not only people, but for animals. And I think in a book like this, some people would overlook that for some reason. But I was really happy to see that.
Thank you. My family has always had animals, either agricultural animals or what you might call pets. I've found myself disliking the term pet as I researched for this book. So I've almost trained it out of my language, because I never thought about the fact that it sort of implies this form of ownership and subservience that could lead us to have a dismissive attitude about what their role in our lives has been. And these animals are companions. They're part of our family, and they deserve to be treated as such. And we know psychologically that human beings respond to the death of an animal in their life no differently than that of a human death. And yet we deride people when they need time or space for that grief. And I think it's long past time that we took a hard look at that and thought differently about it.
Yeah, it was really important that you wrote that, and it made me smile. So did some of the other parts of the book. I smiled a lot, and I learned a lot. I scratched my head a lot and said, "Oh, why didn't I know that?" Because it just seems so common that I didn't. So I felt really bad about that. Now, there's also, if people are very crafty, there's a chapter on restorative arts and crafts, which is hands-on instructions for things like coffin making, creating life and death masks, and even making shrouds. And that's, I I've seen this before. Some company is selling this thing about making your own coffin. You know, it's a kit. And people are going, well, why would I need that? What would I do with it? And as you said in the book, it can be a bookcase, you know, until you really need it, right?
Wait, for all us fabulous witchy folk out there, what's more fun than a coffin bookshelf, knowing that one day your family can shuffle the books off it and put you in there? I would love to be buried in my bookshelf. I think that's very fitting.
It would be hands-on, definitely. It would be to your liking, exactly. Do coffins, if you go to a mortuary, can you bring your own coffin? Is there are some kind of... There's no kind of like size requirements or material requirements or anything like that?
You can absolutely take your own. You could build it out of plywood sheets from Lowe's if you wanted and spend less than $60. And it's such a cathartic experience, even if you're never going to use it and you're going to gift it to the local Fall Fest to use in their haunted house. It there's just something really powerful about doing that for yourself and just saying, this is the shape I fit in. I think I was reading a paper recently. I'm such a huge boring dork. Everyone should know that. But I was reading a paper recently about doorways in Scandinavian burial practices. And yeah, we think about that part of the world, and we probably think of the Viking, you know, ship burial lighting things on fire. Mm-hmm. But that didn't really happen much, actually. A person was more likely to be buried in a ship or cremated on land, for example. But you would see things like burials with stones in the shape of a ship around them, that sort of thing. Mm-hmm. But oftentimes families would build false doorways. If you've ever built a house or restored a room or something, you've probably seen the door frame with the door in it at Lowe's or whatever. Mm-hmm. So they would build something kind of like that they would bury their loved one in, or they would stand them up outside their home. And these doorways would be a manufactured place where they could speak to the dead.
Oh,
it,
wow.
It's sort of this manufactured liminality. And I think that's so interesting. This idea that a doorway is a place that creates a here and a there, an inside and an outside, an us and a them, right? It sort of forces a kind of transience. We respond to doors, right? Mm-hmm. They stop us. Locked or not, we pause at a door. Mm-hmm. And I think building a coffin is a lot like that. It's a kind of manufactured liminality. You build that box and you recognize that that's the shape that holds you, that it's a space that contains you. It's your ship to the underworld. It's an in-between. And I think that's really magical.
It is. The only magic that would be bad is if you were 20 years old and you built your coffin and you were very thin and, you know, wanted to have a smallish coffin so people will know you were petite, but you lived to be 102 and you gained a lot of weight, and then somebody would have to keep that as a coffee table or a bookshelf because you wouldn't fit in it anymore.
If you looked at the instructions, you would know that's very easy to retrofit. You just need a new head and footboard and make it a little bit wider.
There you go. And you know, I also like the idea of death masks, life masks, and shrouds are very easy to make, aren't they?
They are. You can make them without sewing. You can make them with sewing. Whatever is necessary. Anyone that's wrapped a little baby up in a blanket knows exactly what I'm talking about. You lay them catty corner and you fold the corners over the middle and tuck in the top and bottom. It's not hard stuff.
And there are people that are really concerned about what to bury somebody in or what they're going to be buried in. And kind of with a shroud, that could take away that worry, you know. I mean, you could just, whatever's underneath is underneath, but the shroud could be a beautiful shroud and very fancy and or just plain and you know, do it your way.
Or you could take a page from the ancient Egyptians and bury them in what would be called the clothes of yesterday, which is something worn or handed down because it's filled with memories.
Yes. Yeah. No, that's a great idea as well. All right, we've got a couple of minutes left, peeking at the clock, and I want you to give out your website information where people can subscribe, because you have news and updates, you have events, you have a blog, and people can check out the store, which has so many wonderful things, like candles and oils and incense and spell kits and items to use in spell work, like grave dirt or coffin nails or ghost water. I don't know what ghost water is. Can you quickly tell me what that is?
Well, I will say, just for the record, that I'm super bad at the what I call the used car salesman routine.
I know.
I'm so bad at that. My website is www.mortellus.com. If you search Mortellus or A Crow and the Dead, you'll find me basically anywhere except TikTok, because I'm like 1,000 years old and I don't understand it. So I'm not on there. But I do have a lot of things on my website. They're all handmade. I make spell candles, and I use recycled pieces of used coffin for wood wicks in them, which is a project I'm really, really proud of. Corpse water is water that I've used in the prep room to wash a deceased person with, which has a lot of magical uses. Corpse water is, or ghost water rather, is ritually made. I suppose we could make moon water jokes about it, in that I have taken water and given it the qualities of death by asking spirits to move through it.
That makes good sense.
So there are a lot of interesting items on there, and I always like to tell people that if I have something you need, a service, a class, anything, and it's outside of your ability to afford, message me privately and I'll make sure you get it for free. No questions asked. Wow. But I will also say to anyone listening that my work is 100% volunteerism. I am not what you would call employed, and I don't receive any royalties for my work at this time writing. So I am absolutely fully supported by donations and sales on my website. So if you want to support the work that I do, there's a little link in my link tree and in the header of my website where you can donate through my PayPal or buy something cool from my website.
Yeah, because there's a lot of cool stuff there. Honestly, there is. So now we know that you're going to have to come back when your necromancer book comes out. So I'm giving you fair warning. I will be knocking out your door or sending messages through a portal to ask you to come back.
We'll get one of those freestanding doors.
Carry
it up to the lawn.
Yeah, that'll work for me. So thank you so much for sharing the book tonight. And you just got a compliment in the chat room. She said, I thought this would be a grim and depressing topic, but it wasn't.
Oh, I don't think death is very grim at all. I'll leave you with this thought. I think that magic that we do that's about life is always going to be about walking clockwise around a circle, marching toward our inevitable death. But necromancy, death magic, it always functions on reversals, which means turning around and looking at the life we've been given, looking at birth and youth and the joys of the here and the now. So I don't think death is very grim at all.
Well, thank you for sharing. And like I said, I really enjoyed the book. It made me think. I learned a lot. And I want to also thank everybody who's listening in, whether they're on podcast or live or whatever. And until next time, everybody, blessed be and merry meet again. Good night.
Merry Pride.
This has been another edition of Stirring the Cauldron with Marla Brooks. Be sure to tune in next week at the same time for another great guest and more fun. Any rebroadcast or other use of this program without permission is strictly prohibited. Copyright 2009.
You have been listening to the Para-X Radio Network.